The nonprofit MBA purpose is to provide new business insights and fresh creative ideas for executive directors and their teams that will help them improve their organization. Here is your host, Stephen Halasnik.
Welcome, everyone. My name is Stephen Halasnik. I'll be your host for today's nonprofit MBA podcast, which I have been for the past 6 years. I am co-founder of Financing Solutions, and Financing Solutions is the leading provider in the United States for the last 13 years for nonprofits. We provide lines of credit to them. They love them. It's just, I'm not trying to sell you on it. Either you need it or you don't, but it's a very popular product because, as you may or may not know, it's almost next to impossible to get approved for a line of credit for a nonprofit from other sources. So if you're interested in learning more about the product, please visit our website at nonprofitmbapodcast.com. And today we have a sponsor, as we have for a while now, Araize Fast Fund Online. It's spelled A-R-A-I-Z-E. It is excellent accounting software that is made specifically for small to medium-sized nonprofits. It also has fundraising in it and payroll. It's all in one single solution. It's so much better than QuickBooks. As I mentioned before, one of the nonprofits I'm on the board on, we switched to them. We're really happy with them. And if you're interested in learning more about this product, it's not expensive at all. Please visit their website at araize.com, A-R-A-I-Z-E.com, and you can learn more. Today, I am extremely excited to be speaking with Michelle Merritt from DNS Career Management. With Michelle, she's drawing on over 20 years of corporate career as a Fortune 500 recruiter and corporate culture executive. Michelle provides a wealth of experience for her clients, and today she guides us, guides executive leaders through the end-to-end job search process, for resume writing to negotiating offers. She is recognized as a civic and local leader, and she serves on several community and volunteer boards. And also, she has the Guinness Book of World Records for the most funds raised for a nonprofit. Is that correct, Michelle?
It is not. I do have a Guinness record, but the Guinness record is actually for the largest high heel race in the world that raised over $100,000 a year for a local nonprofit in my community.
A high heel race? Did you say that?
Yes. So, are you familiar with an event called Walk a Mile in Her Shoes?
No. Tell me about it.
Many of your listeners probably are. It is an opportunity for primarily men to walk a mile in red high heels. You'll see the size 13 men's red high heel behind me if you're watching the video. And 4-inch red high heels, men step out and walk a mile. And they raise funds to, as sponsors, they get sponsors for that event. And it's all that money is donated to rape crisis centers, sexual assault treatment centers, and gives men the opportunity to speak up and speak out against sexual assault. So in 2010, Fort Wayne, Indiana set the Guinness record for the largest high heel race in the world. And I was fortunate enough to chair that event that year. So this is actually the Guinness record right behind me.
Yeah, cool. What made me think of it is, okay, so we're going to walk in high heels to support women's causes. Well, it doesn't have to be women, but what would the women do to support a man's cause?
Women actively support men's causes every day of their lives.
I knew that was going to come, but what? Isn't that a little sexist, honestly? I mean, we get called on sexism all the time, but what would you have to do to support, we're walking in high heels. What would you have to do? Can you think of one?
I think of lots of causes that I support every day.
Yeah, that's not what I meant. I meant men are doing the high heels. What would women have to do to walk in our shoes?
We'd comfortably wear flats.
Yeah, but that's easy. The high heels is impossible. So
it's not impossible. We do it every single day.
Yeah, I get it. Well, very good. So let's jump into today's topic, executive resume and career management advice for nonprofit leaders. So to start off the bat, you know, what do you think you get called about the most when it comes to nonprofit leaders, when it comes to executive resume and career management? What do you think you get called about the most?
From a resume standpoint, we do both resume creation and we do executive coaching throughout the career transition. From the resume standpoint, what we see with nonprofit executives is really the need to tell the story in a way that highlights accomplishments and achievements and what sets you apart from your peers, not just the task and the doing, right? But the actual outcome. And that's where people most often struggle with their story is, I can tell you everything that's in my job description, but have I really kept track and kept account of everything I've done and the accomplishments and the outcome for my organization for my constituents, for my board, et cetera?
Yeah, I call that anchors, anchor, like what is it that you've really accomplished that you can point to instead of just, you know, I've worked for this company for 20 years, you know, is that what you're saying basically?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we want to do more than tell the job description, right? We want to talk about the impact you've had. You've transitioned, you've transformed an organization. That's great. But there's more than the doing of the transformation. It's the outcome and the impact of the work, specifically with data and metrics where available and appropriate, because they allow the reader the opportunity to understand the depth of your responsibilities. I always remind people that your resume is about you, but it's not for you, it's for the reader. And that's a shift from the traditional way of thinking about a resume.
Do you find that nonprofit leaders' thought process in regards to their resume and even the way they first design it is significantly different than the way a for-profit executive would design their resume?
I think often for-profit executives are already focused on the vision and the overarching leadership of the organization, where often nonprofit executives are tasked with so many additional things, right? You all are doing multiple jobs at one time. Not that for-profit isn't, but you're expected to do it because people are banking on your passion for the subject, and that makes people ask you to do more, I think, sometimes. And so you're so focused on the doing that, again, you forget to take account of what you've done.
Do you find that, I don't know, well, you get into career advice too. So do you find that that's a fault of a nonprofit leader that they're not focused on the end result as much? You know, and it's obvious that they just don't often have all the resources that often it's easier for a for-profit executive to stay very, very focused on results because they often have other people they can delegate to much easier, right? Do you find that a nonprofit leader, once you give them career advice, and I don't know if you get this much into depth, once they see how their resume should be written based on more results oriented, do you think they change their behavior after that?
Some do. Some do. We coach clients not only in the resume building, but also in the career search process to begin really thinking about how they articulate those accomplishments and those achievements, right? How they take ownership. Oftentimes we will hear nonprofit leaders say we more than they say I.
Yeah.
Right? Because they're focused on the team a little bit more. And so we want you to start taking ownership of those achievements. So when you're in the interview conversation, when you're in a networking conversation, you want to make sure that you're using I, that you're taking ownership and saying I and being willing to claim the accomplishment and the achievement.
What percentage of the time are you dealing with a nonprofit leader who says, I want to get out of this space, I want to move back into outside of the nonprofit space? What percentage of the time do you deal with people like that?
I would say of our nonprofit clients, it's about a 50-50 split.
So what I was asking, let me clarify my question, and maybe you answered it the way I was looking for. So you're dealing with these nonprofit leaders and they say, you know what, I'm sick of the nonprofit space. Mm-hmm. I want to move out of that. I want to go to the for-profit. Is that what is 50-50?
Right. I would say 50% of the time, a nonprofit leader comes to us and says, I'm ready to move out.
Yeah.
I'm worn out. I'm tired. I want to go back to for-profit, or I want to consider for-profit for the first time, something like that. And another 50% of the time, people are looking to stay.
And what have you found? Thank you. I'm sorry I misinterpreted, but you answered it the way I was looking for. Now, when they do make that transition to trying to make it to the for-profit world, switch, not up, it's not up, it's not down, it's a change. What have you found the hesitation has been? Has it been good, a positive thing for people in the for-profit world who are interviewing those candidates? Has it been a negative? You know, what have you seen?
So I think there's two things. Number one, if the nonprofit candidate can articulate the business value of their work, for-profit entities are more likely to talk with them. But also remember that in a case like this, where you're making a transition from one sector to another, it is your network that's going to help you the most.
Yeah.
Right. Just the same as a nonprofit, when you're considering a new organization for another nonprofit, right? Likely someone from the board or someone from your network has said, hey, there's this going on over here, right? If you want to actively pursue for-profit industries, leverage your network to make that happen, because they're going to be the people who are your advocates, your champions, your sponsors, who are going to ultimately say, you need to go interview this person, you need to talk to this person, because they really know what they're talking about.
Now, have you stayed on board with those people that you've placed from a nonprofit to a for-profit? Have you stayed on them as a coach sometimes? And what has been the hardest transition that they've had to make?
Two things. Number one is realizing they have a team of people and they don't have to do it all themselves. Right. So being able to delegate and lead from a place of delegation. And then number two, focusing on the outcomes again, and the vision that is for-profit executive leadership, not just the doing.
Gotcha. Now I would assume another part of the nonprofit, career change is they want to go to a bigger nonprofit. I guess you might have both, right? Do you have you had many situations where a nonprofit executive is sick of a large corporate nonprofit environment and they want to go down?
Once in a while. That's less frequent than people looking for the larger ones.
But they're looking
and
for
that
the
compensation,
larger.
That's based on compensation.
It's a compensation thing. Okay, I gotcha. Yeah. So when executive directors or whoever in a nonprofit goes from a smaller nonprofit to a larger nonprofit, I would think the conditions that you just told me exist again, where they have to learn how to delegate more because they have more resources. But where have you seen the difference in how someone has to change going from a smaller nonprofit to a bigger nonprofit?
It's articulating that value and that understanding of a larger board, that understanding of the bigger purpose, the understanding of bigger leadership components, right? So vision, forecasting, finances, all of that becomes larger, as
yeah.
you know, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so we have to be able to demonstrate that we have those leadership abilities. And so that
yeah.
might be in articulating what you've done for a large event or for fundraising or challenges you've solved for your team, things like that, working directly with your board, working with committees, things like that. There are multiple ways to demonstrate that, but you really have to show that bigger picture leadership when you're making that step forward.
How big would a nonprofit organization need to be before they decide that they're going to hire a headhunter to find the right executive director to come in? 20 million?
I think that depends greatly on the organization, right? I think that, and it depends on the board.
Yeah.
Right? Some boards are really willing to dig in and do the work of putting together a search committee and finding that person themselves. Others feel that that's not a wise use of their time and resources. So yeah. it varies greatly depending on the board.
So now you've been doing this for over 20 years. And during that time frame, actually the last 30 years, you know, we've seen, you know, online job boards and, you know, are online job boards as big as they used to be in career searches?
They are. They're not necessarily at the executive level. They're not your best resource, however. So 85% of jobs are found through people we know, not yeah. through applying online. That's a statistic that comes directly from LinkedIn, and they own one of the biggest job boards, right? So what we know is that with 85% of our ROI coming from our network, that's where we need to spend 85% of our time. So to translate that in a 5-day work week, 85% of our time looks like about 4 days a week networking and 1 day a week applying online.
And what for nonprofit executives, what is the leading job board for them?
I would still say it's LinkedIn and Indeed.
Okay.
Those are still your two best resources out there. But again, focus on that network first.
Is Monster still around?
It is. It's not as popular for executive positions.
Yeah, yeah. And is there a vertical online career job for just nonprofits?
There probably are. I'm not as familiar with yeah. those because, again, we coach our clients to really focus in on their network first.
Yeah, yeah. So most of the listeners today are smaller nonprofit organizations. They're under 5 million in revenue. You know, it could be 100,000 in revenue, it could be smaller, whatever.
Sure.
And so let's say you've been an executive director at, you know, your organization for a couple of years now. Although, you know, I think the average tenure is 18 months,
probably.
I think, something like that. So anyway, so you've been at your organization for a while and you want to make a change. And you're listening today to this podcast. What is the first thing that you're looking at, you're saying, and the person who's listening saying, you know what, I want to make a change, right? Mm-hmm. What do you think is the first step?
So I think the first step is identifying what you want to do next. And that might be a variety of things, right? That might be considering a larger nonprofit, but that also might be stepping into the for-profit sector in something, right? So it's identifying those next steps. You can simultaneously pursue multiple things. There's nothing that says you can only pursue, you know, a step up in nonprofit, right? We don't ever want people to pigeonhole themselves, but we do have to have a direction as to where we're going. And then our next step is always to start to take accountability of what you've accomplished and what you've achieved. So start writing that resume in a way that is accomplishment focused and really highlighting what has set you apart from your peers, because that will force you to take ownership of what you've done, which will help you articulate that in the networking conversations that are to come. So those are the first two steps. Identify where you're headed, where you want to go, and then start to really put that resume together in a way that is accomplishment focused for the reader, not necessarily just for what you think you're proud of.
Well, I think the first step too, Michelle, would be I honestly would say, not just because you're a guest on this show, but I would call you first and start to engage your services. I mean, but we all know that we start thinking about these things and then, you know, there's just not enough time in the day and you just keep pushing it off and you keep pushing it off.
Sure.
And, you know, months go by, a year goes by, it never gets done. Mm-hmm. Right. I would bring you on board because you would hold me accountable to getting the things done that I'm supposed to get done, which is getting the resume together, which is doing it the right way, which is like you said, the first step is, okay, where do I want to go? Plus you would help open my eyes as to what opportunity. I remember at one point I was kind of at a dead end in one of my, let's just say it's in my career. And I thought I had no options. And I brought on a coach and the coach was like, you have so many options, tons of options. And it made me feel so much better. right? Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, you know? And so, you know, I think, you know, switching jobs and interviewing mm-hmm. with other companies and organizations is really hard emotionally, time-wise, right? Isn't it like
they tough? Say it's one of the most stressful things you'll ever do, yeah. along with having a baby and buying a house, yeah. right? So having good help, and I appreciate you pointing that out, having good help to guide you through makes a difference, right?
Yeah.
Now, I will be very clear that our process is a collaborative one. You don't get to just dump all of your data with us and we magically make it happen.
Yeah, yeah.
You have to participate in yeah. the process. And yeah. so we collaborate and come alongside our clients to guide them through, but the client is still doing the bulk of the work. We're doing the resume writing, of course, but you have to go out and identify who's in your network, start reaching out, get out of your comfort zone and get comfortable being uncomfortable.
Oh yeah. It's almost like doing a podcast. You know, I mean, you know, I'm supposed to be asking all the questions, you know, right. not giving the answers. So, right. Yeah, yeah, I get it. Are you seeing, right now that pay, when you see somebody switch from an existing nonprofit that's smaller going to making a change, are you seeing a significant jump in pay?
Depends on the organization and depends on if they're going to another nonprofit or a for-profit. Obviously, we will see when you're switching to for-profit, often we'll see a much larger compensation package there.
Yeah.
And a lot of that comes with benefits and things like that just can't be provided in a small nonprofit. And so there are lots of ways to negotiate compensation in the nonprofit sector as well as the for-profit. But as you're stepping up, say, from a smaller nonprofit to to the next size of and staying in the nonprofit sector, you should see an increase as well. If you're not, and you're being asked to take on more responsibility, things like that, that could be a yellow flag at least, if not a red one for me.
So since you've been doing this over the last couple of years, what have you seen the people who are looking for a change? What has been changing in what they've been looking for?
So a couple things, especially for people staying in the nonprofit sector. They're often looking for better support from their board, right? They're looking for better support from their leadership. So if they're not an executive director, but possibly a VP, something like that, they're looking for better support, right? They're looking to know that they've been valued, right? And that comes in a variety of forms. That can come in compensation. It certainly should come in compensation, in my opinion. But it also can come in getting help, right? Helping you hire more people. A committee actually stepping up and getting involved in the way they committed to get involved, but maybe are not. Things like that. So we're looking for more support. We're often looking for more benefits, right? Whether that is paid time off, whether that is better insurance benefits, retirement funds, that sort of thing. So compensation comes in that form as well. And lastly, we're often looking for some flexibility. Do you really need that person to be in the office of a small nonprofit, right? Do you need that? Do you truly need that overhead of renting an office space for two people when that could be done and provide more flexibility in a remote work environment, for example, things like that.
So what questions haven't I asked that you want to tell us about that is something that's on your mind?
So I think there are a couple other things that nonprofit execs come to us often for is guidance through interviewing and guidance through salary negotiation would be the two other things that people often talk to us about.
And so tell me some of the interview questions that you are obvious to you that they will ask, but is not obvious to a nonprofit director. Now you talked about one already, which is, you know, making sure you counsel them to think of the measurements or results that they've achieved, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I'm assuming once you get that on a resume, when people start asking you questions, it's easier for people to start moving into that train of thought where, you know, I increased my organization's, you know, revenue by, you know, 80% of the last 2 years or whatever it is, you know, it's at, you know, once you can change your vernacular, conversation that way, if that's the right way to put it, then it gets obvious. But what are some of the things that you have to often tell your clients, you need to be prepared on this one?
Yeah. I think the biggest thing is being willing to have a conversation, right? So know your topics going into. So there's the dreaded tell me about yourself question. I'm happy to see that many organizations are starting to do away with the tell me about yourself question, because candidates often give information that is illegal to share. And so as a result, companies have just quit asking it. But there are several, especially in the nonprofit sector, who will still ask it, because likely if they're not using a professional recruiting firm, the people putting the interviews together are not experts at interviewing, right? They're board members who come from finance or marketing or something like that. So they're not accustomed to interviewing people. So the tell me about yourself question is always an important one. But then it's also the tell me about a time when, those case scenario sort of questions, right? They're looking for you to answer most likely in what we refer to as the STAR interview method. And that may be something very common to your listeners. It may not be. So situation, task, action, result, right? We want to define the situation and the task that was required. We want to share the action we took and the outcome or the result of what that was, right? So we're looking for someone to tell us a story, bring us along in the story, but we need to keep those answers succinct to say less than 2 minutes in length. And we want to keep the answers with as few of characters as possible. What do I mean by that? If you're asked, tell me about a time when you had to manage a difficult team, right? You want a story that only contains one or two people in the story, because otherwise it's hard for the listener to follow along. And just like the resume is about you, but not for you, your interview is about you, but not for you. It's for the listener. So we want to engage the listener in a story that's easy to follow along with, but certainly has some punch to it.
I would assume that if you have a leader who's an introvert, that you have to get them to talk more. And that if you have someone who's an extrovert, you have to get them to talk less or be more succinct.
Succinct is important. But I will also say that sometimes introverts will start to ramble out of nervousness.
Oh, gotcha.
Right. So we want to just be mindful of our answers. I always say we don't role play in interview prep, right? Because what will happen is I will teach you to answer a certain question. But if the interviewer doesn't ask the question the way I've asked it and trained you to respond to, you're going to get nervous and tripped up. So instead, we look for the topics, right? So the topic might be about fiscal responsibility. It might be about working with the board. It might be about managing your team, things like that, right? Know the examples that you want to talk through based on the topic. So when I'm preparing my notes for an interview, I have my topics listed that I believe will come up because I've done my research, right? I've researched the organization. I've researched the board members who will be in the room. I have researched what's been in the media about the organization, et cetera. So I'm thinking about the topics that might come up, and I'm giving myself a bullet-pointed list of subjects or examples that I want to talk through, but I'm not writing out my answers because I'm going to sound scripted and I'm not going to sound natural in the conversation.
Tell me about the biggest mistakes that people make in the interview process itself, not the process, the interview, when you actually are doing the interview, what do they do that's really a red flag?
Over-preparing is the first one, and wow. Under-preparing is the second.
Oh.
Right? I'm going to go in there and wing it, right? I got this. I'm good at this. I'm just going to go wing it, right? If I had come to you today without thinking ahead of time and making notes and preparing about what is it that our nonprofit clients really want, and thinking about those specific instances, I wouldn't have a good conversation with you. And at the end of the day, the interview is about a conversation. We want it to be conversational. The same is true with over-preparing. Because like we just talked about, we can memorize a script and then get tripped up pretty easily. It actually happened to me in an interview that I was doing. It was an 11-person panel. I knew eight of the people on the panel. That interview was mine to lose. And three different times, the gentleman at the end of the table asked me a specific question. It was not the way I had rehearsed it. And I literally heard the Peanuts teacher, the wah-wah sort of thing. And I couldn't answer the question.
Was he one of the three people that you didn't know?
Correct.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's why he gave me, the opportunity to respond, to come back to the question two or three times, because he knew I knew everyone else at the table.
Yeah.
He was being very generous.
Was it a gotcha question where he
not
was
at
really
all.
Trying to,
not no. at all. Huh. Not at all. And the moment I hit the lobby doors of that office complex, I knew the answer. And I almost ran back in and like screamed it at them.
Yeah.
But they had already dispersed. So it really does happen. Nerves get the better of us sometimes. And when we overprepare, that tends to be the critical piece. The other thing I'll say is engage the interviewers in a conversation.
Yeah.
Right? Especially at an executive level. This interview should be a conversation. If they're allowing eight questions to be asked of you, followed by two questions that you can ask of them and no conversation in between, that's a red flag to me, right? We're all supposed to be putting our best foot forward in these conversations. And if their best foot forward is only allowing you to ask two questions, boy, I'd be cautious there, right? Instead, find the themes in the interview. So what do I mean by that? If someone is asking lots of questions about toxic employees, how do you manage difficult people? How do you bring in change for your team? How do you handle the meeting after the meeting? Things like that. If that interview is full of questions like that, ask them, hey, I'm detecting a theme here. Tell me what's going on with your people. Because I'm noticing you're asking a lot of questions that way. What's up?
Yeah. You know, So it's been 37 years since I've actually, 35 years since I've actually interviewed for a position.
Lucky you.
But I've interviewed thousands of people, mm-hmm. right? For me to hire them. Not just in interviews, but that's the topic right now. I can tell how smart somebody is based on the questions they ask me, not what they tell me. And often if I'm in an interview and I have to ask all the questions, I'm not as enamored with that candidate as I am with somebody who puts me on the hot seat, mm-hmm. you know, and asks me a lot of questions about the company, right? So if someone does that, then I'm like, oh, this person is really on the ball.
Right.
Now it's just me, but you know, I remember one of the best people I ever hired, you know, she really interviewed me I was interviewing her and she's interviewing me and she was asking me really good questions that really made me think. Mm-hmm. And that, I was really impressed with her and she turned out to be an amazing employee for me. So I agree with you. So, and I'll articulate it this way, but you tell me if you think this is the right way to go. And I think if the people who are interviewing you, whether it be a board or a person, has all of the control in that interview process, then you've made a big mistake that it should be almost like a 50-50 split. Like, you should be asking as many questions as they're asking. Is that mm-hmm. fair?
I normally go with a 60-40 split. Let them ask 60% of the questions. But yes, I agree. I think that, again, it's a red flag. It's a yellow flag, at least. But for me, most of the time, it's a red flag. When someone doesn't allow me to engage as the executive in the room, you know, you're called there because you are the expert on you. Right. And so this is your opportunity to interview them and find out their expertise about the organization as well. So again, look for those hidden themes that are coming up in the conversation and fire back questions. Not in an aggressive way, but hey, tell me about this. What about this? Oh, okay, you've asked this. What if we go here?
Yeah.
Sort of thing.
Yeah. And I think I don't like, Michelle, the idea that they're giving you an opportunity. I don't think you should have an opportunity. I think you should be looking for those opportunities. Like you said, when they when they were saying, you know, when the conversation's leading in a way where you can see a theme there, like you said, like if they start asking you a lot of questions about how you've handled conflict mm-hmm. in your organization, I mean, that's a yellow flag to me. And I'd say is, well, maybe you can share with me a little bit about the past history of this organization in regards to employee development or, you know, conflict resolution. Has there been an issue in the past that I, you know, that you can tell me about? Right.
Well, I have a client right now who is interviewing for a large nonprofit organization. The prior executive director left in quite a media frenzy in their community. Right. And so in doing her due diligence, she has found out about a lot of these things going on. She needs to go in and ask about these things, right? To say, okay, I've seen the media, I've heard the media side of what's happened here. Tell me your perspective on what went wrong and what needs to change.
Yeah. And I think it gets to a point where, you know, you can't be so needy that you want that job so bad.
Correct.
That you just go in it blindly because you might be going into a situation where you're going to fail, you know?
Absolutely. And that's easy to say when we're not sitting here without a job, right? Yeah. So when we are in a position where we have lost our job or our nonprofit has closed or something like that, and we do not have an income right now, it can be really easy to just dive in because we feel we have to, and then tell ourselves we'll find another job in a couple of years if need be. But that can really harm your long-time career trajectory, right? It can harm your reputation. It can harm your relationships, things like that. So think about the long game as best you can. Even if that means picking up some fractional work or some consulting work to get you through so that you're making good long-term decisions for your career.
Good stuff. I'm going to ask you one last question and then we're going to wrap it up. But it's a little bit different than what the topic we've been going toward. What has been the changes in relation to how your LinkedIn profile should relate to your written resume?
I think it's important that your LinkedIn profile, that your resume inform the content of your LinkedIn profile, but it does not need to be a direct copy of your LinkedIn profile, right? So some people are not comfortable putting the data, the metrics, things like that in their profile. That's perfectly fine.
Gotcha.
But, you know, have more than your job description. Talk about what you've accomplished in these roles and use LinkedIn to demonstrate your expertise. Be posting regularly. Regularly, I mean, 2 or 3 times a week so that you engage your audience. Talk about your industry. Talk about things that are going on in your organization if you're still employed. Promote your organization. Promote things in your industry. Ask questions. Engage with others. And do it in a way that not only is posting online, but is also commenting and engaging on other people's posts. More than just, hey, great post or hey, great question. But really thoughtful engagement, because when you post, when you comment on someone else's post, you see your title, you see the person's name, and you get a feel for who they are based on how they're engaging. So engage with LinkedIn. Don't just have a profile. And that can be 5 minutes a day. That's why I tell people, set the first 5 minutes of the day to engage on LinkedIn, set a timer so you don't get sucked into the social media black hole, and hop back out after 5 minutes.
Yeah, I always tell him, I have a 23-year-old son. I have a 15-year-old son too, but a 23-year-old son, I'm always telling him, and he's very mature for his age. But I always said, you know, your name and what you do is a brand. And you always have to be careful about, you know, your brand. Okay. So you got to keep improving it and you know, those, the type of things that we know what brands are about. So authenticity, those type of things. So, good. Really good podcast today. I certainly learned a lot. I knew today was going to be fun and enjoyable. So I want to thank so very much Michelle Merritt from DNS Career Management for coming on today's podcast. And if you like today's podcast, please feel free to share it with a friend and also subscribe on your favorite podcasting app. The Nonprofit MBA Podcast is in the top 1% of podcasts in the nonprofit space. We're very proud of that. And those reviews that you give us, if they're five stars, really help get the word out. And wow, we've had so many great guests like Michelle. And if you just like scroll through the past topics, you'll find tons of things that will help you in your career and in your organization. And if you're looking for a line of credit for your organization, please feel free to visit our website at nonprofitmbapodcast.com. And Michelle, if anybody wants to get in touch with you, how would they go about doing that?
So they can either find our website, dscareermanagement.com, or they can connect with me on LinkedIn. And it's just LinkedIn/IN/Michelle Merritt, all one word, two L's, two R's, two T's, basically two of everything.
Yep. Great. So it's, and it's again, it's dscareermanagement.com.
Correct.
So yep. Sounds great. Okay. All right. Well, thanks for coming on.
All right. Thanks for having me.
So I want to end today's podcast as I always have, and I want to thank our listeners, not just for listening. I thank you for that, but for trying to make the world a better place. It's a rough and tumble world out there. And every day you guys are out there trying to make the world better for us all. And I thank you for that. I just want to remind you that you are no good to your family, your employees, your friends, yourself, if you don't take care and think of yourself first, because I know that you're all very compassionate out there and caring, and you think of everybody else, but you don't think about yourself as much. And you need to kind of do that every day. You know, think about, okay, what can I do today to keep my sanity? And because saving the world is a marathon, not a sprint. And so make sure you're doing the right things, you're exercising, you're meditating, you're praying, whatever it does for you to center yourself and to be whole again so that you can handle this rough and tumble world out there. So just please keep that in mind. And I want to thank you again for listening to the Nonprofit MBA podcast.